Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and this is the first of two podcasts based around Arthur Conan Doyle and Christmas. Conan Doyle isn't an author that we naturally associate with Christmas by any means. He wrote a couple of Christmas stories during his long career. But he was an author who was regularly and very successfully used by magazines at Christmas time. It's worth bearing in mind that Conan Doyle becomes a household name, really with the success of the Sherlock Holmes stories in short story format, which happens in 1891, and I'll come to that in the second podcast. But by that point, by the time A Scandal in Bohemia appeared in the July 1891 issue of the Strand magazine, Conan Doyle had been a published author for a dozen years. He was born in 1859. His first short story published appeared when he was 20 years old, in 1879. And over the next decade, he had over 40 stories published. That's before Sherlock Holmes goes into short story format. 40 short stories published in a whole range of magazines. And, of course, a handful of novels as well. A couple of rather well-known novellas, Study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four, the first two Sherlock Holmes novels. By 1891, he'd also written his first two great historical novels, Micah Clarke and The White Company. The White Company, in fact, was being serialised during 1891. And he'd written a variety of other things as well. And he'd done all that in his spare time, essentially, because, as you may know, he spent most of the 1880s as a professional doctor, for most of that time, based in Southsea, on the south coast of England in the county of Hampshire, a suburb of the great naval base of Portsmouth. And that's where Doyle establishes himself eventually in medical practice. That's where he gets married, it's where his first daughter's born, and it's where he writes and writes in his spare time. It's where he creates Sherlock Holmes, of course. In a sense, Sherlock Holmes will always be associated with Christmas because the very first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, was published in Beaton's Christmas Annual for 1887, copies of which are so scarce that if you find one in your attic, don't just pop it on eBay and hope for the best. Contact an auction house in a rather more formal way and see how much money you get for it. These are incredibly rare items. But it wasn't intended as a Christmas story. Study in Scarlet was actually written in the spring of 1886, and like an awful lot of Doyle's fiction, it went the rounds of various publishers in manuscript. It went backwards and forwards until it was finally accepted. And even then, they held off publication to put it into that Christmas Annual. And bearing in mind that Conan Doyle dies in 1930, it gives him a career as a published author of over 50 years. And for nearly every one of those 50 years, with a couple of exceptions, he has some new story in a Christmas magazine. This might be part of a serial that he's written, or it could be a short story that has been held back, as in later years a number of the Sherlock Holmes stories would be held back so that they would appear to boost sales in the Strand magazine's Christmas issues. But when Doyle wrote A Study in Scarlet and when he wrote The Sign of Four, he didn't have the sense at that point of a planned saga. He had no epic voyage of Holmes and Watson in view at that point. He hadn't planned a seven-novel series, for example, or anything like that. He was simply writing all kinds of different things that occurred to him. The breadth of his output in the 1880s is quite wonderful, because he'd write about almost anything. He does several brilliant articles for the British Journal of Photography. He's a very keen photographer, and his articles are great fun to read. He writes anything he's commissioned to write. Testing gas pipes for leakage is not the most riveting thing that came from his pen, but he was pleased to be paid for writing that article. And one of the rewarding things about reading a lot of Doyle's very early work, written in his 20s and early 30s, is that you often see where he's going to go with later and better-known works. So nearly every Christmas, there's a Conan Doyle short story in a magazine. And in the 1880s, his work appeared in London Society, Temple Bar, the Cornhill magazine, that really rather distinguished magazine, that had three in it at different times. And some of his early pieces, he later wasn't very keen on and didn't collect them himself again when he came to republish his work later on and gather together things like Tales of Adventure and Medical Life and so on, these anthologies. He was quite happy to leave a number of them behind because he felt they didn't represent his mature writing. He wasn't much of a reviser of his own work. Not like, for example, Agatha Christie. And if you've been on my Agatha Christie virtual tour, you'll know that Christie a number of times took short stories and expanded them, things like The Second Gong, which became Dead Man's Mirror, and she did all kinds of revisions to her work at different times. Doyle tended not to do that. He tended to finish something and move on, and not tinker with it afterwards. And that makes the story that appeared in Chambers' Journal 130 years ago this month, I'm recording this in December 2020, so we're talking about December 1890, the story that appeared then, it makes it a really unusual one in Doyle's canon. And it's called The Surgeon of Gaster Fell. Chambers' Journal, by the way, was typical of a lot of publications in the 1880s. It was weekly, costing 1.5p, and comprising usually 16 pages of popular literature, science and art, as it says. And there are no illustrations to it. There's about 70 lines of fairly small typeset in two columns per page. And this is not unusual, a number of magazines that were like this at the time. Within a few years, this had rapidly become very, very old-fashioned, because magazines, particularly starting with the Strand magazine, they were changing the way readers enjoyed their fiction and their factual articles by putting in illustrations to a very large extent. But Chambers is quite free of illustrations. And The Surgeon of Gaster Fell was published over 4 weeks, beginning on the 6th of December, 1890, and finishing on the 27th. So 4 instalments, and set in 4 chapters. And it is a very unusual story, because Doyle did collect it in a volume, but not for many, many years, when he finally allowed it officially to see the light of day again. And for its revived publication, he trimmed about a third of the text. Now, some of it is trimmed probably because Doyle was feeling that he was, as a 20-something author, because he actually wrote it in 1888 and it was published in 1890, as a 20-something author, he was perhaps showing off his knowledge and his reading and being a little bit elaborate, perhaps. And some of it is probably pruned for those reasons. But some of it is obviously pruned to remove the local detail that he put in the story. Because Kirby Malhouse and Gaster Fell, in the original version, are very, very clearly set in and around the area of Thornton in Lonsdale, which is in the West Riding of Yorkshire, up on the Pennines. It's practically across the border in the Westmorland and Lancashire counties as they then were. Was West Yorkshire. And Doyle knew the place because his mother had lived for a number of years there. In fact, at Christmas 1890, at the time this story was being published, Doyle and his wife Louise had gone to see his mother. They spent part of Christmas at Mason Gill, at Thornton in Lonsdale. Now, why Doyle pruned it and why he removed nearly all those local bits of local detail from the later version? is not absolutely certain. But without giving too much away before we get to the end, there were some personal elements in Doyle's life that weren't known to the general public at all, and that he might have wished to steer away from, and perhaps felt he'd gone a little bit too close to, when he was writing this. When Doyle writes about the bleak and savage landscape of the story, and it's a landscape in the Pennines that I'm very familiar with, it's not a great leap to fast forward just over a decade to when he's writing about another rather desolate and atmospheric and sinister part of England. Not the Pennine Dales, but Dartmoor in The Hound of the Baskervilles. But it also has a character who narrates the strange experiences that he has out in the bleak and windswept landscape, not unlike the narration that Dr. Watson will give in The Hound of the Baskervilles. But the narrator isn't really a Watson character. If anything, in his irritability and his desire for solitude and his hatred of publicity, he has quite a lot in common with Sherlock Holmes. So The Surgeon of Gasterfell is, I think, well worth a look, especially if you know that some of its ideas are going to feed into that masterpiece of a few years later on. So, what I'm going to do is read chapters 1 and 2 of The Surgeon of Gasterfell to conclude this podcast. In other words, the installments that were published on December the 6th and December the 13th, 1890. And then the second podcast, I'll pick up the story of Christmas 1890 and Christmas 1891 and what was going on for Doyle then, and read the conclusion of The Surgeon of Gasterfell, the other two chapters. Chambers' Journal of Popular Literature, Science and Art. Saturday, December the 6th, 1890. The Surgeon of Gasterfell. In four chapters. Chapter 1. How the Woman Came to Kirby Malhouse. Bleak and windswept is the little Yorkshire town of Kirby Malhouse, and harsh and forbidding are the fells upon which it stands. It stretches in a single line of grey stone slate-roofed houses, dotted down the furze-clad slope of the long rolling moor. To north and to south stretch the swelling curves of the Yorkshire uplands, peeping over each other's backs for the skyland, with a tinge of yellow in the foreground, which shades away to olive in the distance, save where the long grey scars of rock protrude through the scanty and barren soil. From the little knoll above the church one may see to the westward a fringe of gold upon an arc of silver where the great Morecambe sands are washed by the Irish Sea. To the east, Ingleborough looms purple in the distance, while Penigent shoots up the tapering peak whose great shadow, like nature's own sundial, sweeps slowly round over a vast expanse of savage and sterile country. In this lonely and secluded village, I, James Upperton, found myself in the summer of 85. Little as the wild hamlet had to offer, it contained that for which I yearned above all things, seclusion, and freedom from all which might distract my mind from the high and weighty subjects which engaged it. I was weary of the long turmoil and profitless strivings of life. From early youth my days had been spent in wild adventure and strange experiences, until, at the age of 39, there were few lands upon which I had not set foot, and scarcely any joy or sorrow of which I had not tasted. Among the first of Europeans, I had penetrated to the desolate shores of Lake Tanganyika, and I had twice made my way to those unvisited and impenetrable jungles which skirt the great tableland of the Roraima. As a soldier of fortune, I had served under many flags. I was with Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley, and I fought with Shanzi in the Army of the Loire. It may well seem strange that after a life so exciting, I could give myself up to the dull routine and trivial interests of the West Riding hamlet. And yet, there are excitements of the mind to which mere bodily peril or the exaltation of travel is mean and commonplace. For years, I had devoted myself to the study of the mystic and hermetic philosophies, Egyptian, Indian, Grecian, and medieval, until out of the vast chaos there had dimly dawned upon me a huge, symmetrical design, and I seemed to grasp the key of that symbolism which was used by those learned men to screen their precious knowledge from the vulgar and the wicked. Gnostics and Neoplatonists, Chaldeans, Rosicrucians and Indian mystics, I saw and understood in which each played a part. To me, the jargon of Paracelsus, the mysteries of the alchemists, and the visions of Swedenborg were all pregnant with meaning. I had deciphered the mysterious inscriptions of El Biram, and I knew the import of those strange characters which have been engraved by an unknown race upon the cliffs of southern Turkestan. Immersed in these great and engrossing studies, I asked nothing from life save a garret for myself and for my books, where I might pursue my studies without interference or interruption. But even in the little moorside village I found that it was impossible to shake off the censorship of one's fellow mortals. When I went forth, the rustics would eye me askance, and mothers would whip up their children as I passed down the village street. At night, I have glanced out through my diamond-paned lattice to find that a group of foolish, staring peasants had been craning their necks in an ecstasy of fear and curiosity to watch me at my solitary task. My landlady, too, became garrulous with a clatter of questions under every small pretext, and 100 small ruses and wiles by which to tempt me to speak to her of myself and of my plans. All this was ill to bear, but when at last I heard that I was no longer to be sole lodger, and that a lady, a stranger, had engaged the other room, I felt that indeed it was time for one who sought the quiet and the peace of study to seek some more tranquil surrounding. In my frequent walks, I had learnt to know well the wild and desolate region where Yorkshire borders on both Lancashire and Westmoreland. From Kirby Malhouse I had frequently made my way to this lonesome wilderness, and had traversed it from end to end. In the gloomy majesty of its scenery, and the appalling stillness and loneliness of its rock-strewn melancholy solitudes, it seemed to offer me a secure asylum from espionage and criticism. As it chanced, I had in my rambles come upon an isolated dwelling in the very heart of these lonely moors, which I at once determined should be my own. It was a two-roomed cottage, which had once belonged to some shepherd, but which had long been deserted, and was crumbling rapidly to ruin. In the winter floods, the Gaster Beck, which runs down Gaster Fell, where the little Sheeling stood, had overswept its bank and torn away a portion of the wall. The roof, too, was in ill case, and the scattered slates lay thick amongst the grass. Yet the main shell of the house stood firm and true, and it was no great task for me to have all that was amiss set right. Though not rich, I could yet afford to carry out so modest a whim in a lordly way. There came slaters and masons from Kirby Malhouse, and soon the lonely cottage upon Gaster Fell was as strong and weathertight as ever. The two rooms I laid out in a widely different manner. My own tastes are of a Spartan turn, and the outer chamber was so planned as to accord with them. An oil stove by Rippingill of Birmingham furnished me with the means of cooking, while two great bags, the one of flour and the other of potatoes, made me independent of all supplies from without. In diet, I had long been a Pythagorean, so that the scraggy, long-limbed sheep which browsed upon the wiry grass by the Gaster Beck had little to fear from their new companion. A 9-gallon cask of oil served me as a sideboard, while a square table, a deal chair, and a truckle bed completed the list of my domestic fittings. At the head of my couch hung 2 unpainted shelves, the lower for my dishes and cooking utensils, the upper for the few portraits which took me back to the little that was pleasant in the long, wearisome toiling for wealth and for pleasure which had marked the life I had left behind. If this dwelling room of mine were plain even to squalor, its poverty was more than atoned for by the luxury of the chamber which was destined to serve me as my study. I had ever held that it was best for the mind to be surrounded by such objects as would be in harmony with the studies which occupied it, and that the loftiest and most ethereal conditions of thought are only possible amid surroundings which please the eye and gratify the senses. The room which I had set apart for my mystic studies was set forth in a style as gloomy and majestic as the thoughts and aspirations with which it was to harmonize. Both walls and ceilings were covered with a paper of the richest and glossiest black, on which was traced a lurid and arabesque pattern of dead gold. A black velvet curtain covered the single diamond-paned window, while a thick yielding carpet of the same material prevented the sound of my own footfall as I paced backwards and forwards from breaking the current of my thoughts. Along the cornice ran gold rods, from which depended 6 pictures, all of the sombre and imaginative cast which chimed best with my fancy. 2, as I remember, were from the brush of Fuseli, 1 from Noel Paton, 1 from Gustave Doré, 2 from Martin, with a little watercolour by the incomparable Blake. From the centre of the ceiling hung a single gold thread, so thin as to be scarce visible, but of great toughness. From this swung a dove of the same metal, with wings outstretched. The bird was hollow, and contained perfumed oil, while a sylph-like figure curiously fashioned from pink crystal hovered over the lamp, and imparted a rich and soft glow to its light. A brazen fireplace backed with malachite, 2 tiger skins upon the carpet, a boule table, and 2 reclining chairs in amber plush and ebony completed the furniture of my bijou study, save only that under the window stretched the long bookshelves, which contained the choicest works of those who have busied themselves with the mystery of life. Böhm, Swedenborg, Danton, Bertot, Lachey, Sinnett, Harding, Britton, Dunlop, Amberley, Winwood Reed, De Musso, Alan Kardec, Lepsius, Sefer, Toldo, and the Abbé Dubois. These were some of those who stood marshalled between my oaken shelves. When the lamp was lit of a night, and the lurid flickering light played over the sombre and bizarre surroundings, the effect was all that I could wish. Nor was it lessened by the howling of the wind as it swept over the melancholy waste around me. Here at last, I thought, is a back eddy in life's hurried stream, where I may lie in peace, forgetting and forgotten. And yet, it was destined that ere ever I reached this quiet harbour, I should learn that I was still one of humankind, and that it is an ill thing to strive to break the bond which binds us to our fellows. It was but 2 nights before the date I had fixed upon for my change of dwelling, when I was conscious of a bustle in the house beneath, with the bearing of heavy burdens up the creaking stair, and the harsh voice of my landlady loud in welcome and protestations of joy. From time to time, amid her whirl of words, I could hear a gentle and softly modulated voice, which struck pleasantly upon my ear after the long weeks during which I had listened only to the rude dialect of the dalesmen. For an hour I could hear the dialogue beneath, the high voice and the low, with clatter of cup and clink of spoon, until at last a light, quick step passed my study door, and I knew that my new fellow lodger had sought her room. Already my fears had been fulfilled, and my studies, the worse for her coming. I vowed in my mind that the second sunset should find me installed, safe from all such petty influences, in my sanctuary at Gaster Fell. On the morning after this incident I was up betimes, as is my wont, but I was surprised on glancing from my window to see that our new inmate was earlier still. She was walking down the narrow pathway which zigzags over the fell. A tall woman, slender, her head sunk upon her breast, her arms filled with a bristle of wildflowers which she had gathered in her morning rambles. The white and pink of her dress, and the touch of deep red ribbon in her broad, drooping hat, formed a pleasant dash of colour against the dun-tinted landscape. She was some distance off when I first set eyes upon her, yet I knew that this wandering woman could be none other than our arrival of last night, for there was a grace and refinement in her bearing which marked her from the dwellers of the fells. Even as I watched, she passed swiftly and lightly down the pathway, and turning through the wicket gate at the farther end of our cottage garden, she seated herself upon the green bank which faced my window, and strewing her flowers in front of her, set herself to arrange them. As she sat there, with the rising sun at her back and the glow of morning spreading like an aureole round her stately and well-poised head, I could see that she was a woman of extraordinary personal beauty. Her face was Spanish rather than English in its type, oval, olive, with black, sparkling eyes and a sweetly sensitive mouth. From under the broad straw hat, two thick coils of blue-black hair curved down on either side of her graceful, queenly neck. I was surprised as I watched her to see that her shoes and skirt bore witness to a journey rather than to a mere morning ramble. Her light dress was stained, wet and bedraggled, while her boots were thick with the yellow soil of the fells. Her face, too, wore a weary expression, and her young beauty seemed to be clouded over by the shadow of inward trouble. Even as I watched her, she burst suddenly into wild weeping, and throwing down her bundle of flowers, ran swiftly into the house. Distrait as I was, and weary of the ways of the world, I was conscious of a sudden pang of sympathy and grief as I looked upon the spasm of despair which seemed to convulse this strange and beautiful woman. I bent to my books, and yet my thoughts would ever turn to her proud, clear-cut face, her weather-stained dress, her drooping head, and the sorrow which lay in each line and feature of her pensive face. Again and again I found myself standing at my casement and glancing out to see if there were signs of her return. There on the green bank was the litter of golden gorse and purple marshmallow where she had left them. But through the whole morning I neither saw nor heard anything from her who had so suddenly aroused my curiosity and stirred my long slumbering emotions. Mrs. Adams, my landlady, was wont to carry up my frugal breakfast, yet it was very rarely that I allowed her to break the current of my thoughts or to draw my mind by her idle chatter from weightier things. This morning, however, for once she found me in a listening mood, and with little prompting proceeded to pour into my ears all that she knew of our beautiful visitor. "Miss Eva Cameron be her name, sir," she said. "But who she be, or where she come from, I know little more than yourself. Maybe it was the same reason that brought her to Kirby Mulhouse as fetched you there yourself, sir." "Possibly," said I, ignoring the covert question. "But I should hardly have thought that Kirby Mulhouse was a place which offered any great attractions to a young lady." "It's a gay place when the fair is on," said Mrs. Adams. "Yet maybe it's just health and rest as the young lady is seeking." "Very likely," said I, stirring my coffee. "And no doubt some friend of yours has advised her to seek it in your very comfortable apartments." "Eh, sir," she cried, "there's the wonder of it. The lady has just come from France, and how her folk came to learn of me is just a wonder. A week ago, up comes a man to my door, a fine man, sir, and a gentleman, as one could see with half an eye. 'You are Mrs. Adams,' says he. I engage your rooms for Miss Cameron, says he. She will be here in a week, says he, and then off without a word of terms. Last night there comes the young lady herself, soft-spoken and downcast, with a touch of the French in her speech. But my sakes, sir, I must away and make her some tea, for she'll feel lonesome-like, poor lamb, when she wakes under a strange roof. Chapter 2. How I Went Forth to Gaster Fell. I was still engaged upon my breakfast when I heard the clatter of dishes and the landlady's footfall as she passed towards her new lodger's room. An instant afterwards she had rushed down the passage and burst in upon me with uplifted hands and startled eyes. "Lord a mercy, sir," she cried, "and asking your pardon for troubling you, but I'm feared of the young lady, sir. She's not in her room."
"Why, there she is," said I, standing up and glancing through the casement. "She has gone back for the flowers she left upon the bank."
"Oh, sir, see to her boots and her dress," cried the landlady wildly. "I wish her mother was here, sir, I do. Where she has been is more than I can, but her bed has not been lain on this night."
"She has felt restless, doubtless, and had gone for a walk, though the hour was certainly a strange one." Mrs. Adams pursed her lip and shook her head. But even as she stood at the casement, the girl beneath looked smilingly up at her and beckoned to her with a merry gesture to open the window.
"Have you my tea there?" she asked, in a rich, clear voice, with a touch of the mincing French accent. "It is in your room, miss." "Look at my boots, Mrs. Adams," she cried, thrusting them out from under her skirt. "These fells of yours are dreadful places, effroyable. 1 inch, 2 inch, never have I seen such mud. My dress, too, voila."
"Hey, miss, but you are in a pickle," cried the landlady, as she gazed down at the bedraggled gown. "But you must be main weary and heavy for sleep."
"No, no," she answered, laughing. "I care not for sleep. What is sleep? It is a little death, voila tout. But for me, to walk, to run, to breathe the air, that is to live. I was not tired, and so all night I have explored these fells of Yorkshire."
"Lord a mercy, miss, and where did you go?" asked Mrs. Adams.
She waved her hand round in a sweeping gesture which included the whole western horizon.
"There," she cried. "Oh, comme elles sont tristes et sauvages, ces collines. But I have flowers here. You will give me water, will you not? They will wither else."
She gathered her treasures into her lap, and a moment later we heard her light, springy footfall upon the stair. So she had been out all night, this strange woman. What motive could have taken her from her snug room onto the bleak, wind-swept hills? Could it be merely the restlessness, the love of adventure of a young girl? Or was there, possibly, some deeper meaning in this nocturnal journey? I thought, as I paced my chamber, of her drooping head, the grief upon her face, and the wild burst of sobbing which I had overseen in the garden. Her nightly mission, then, be it what it might, had left no thought of pleasure behind it. And yet, even as I walked, I could hear the merry tinkle of her laughter, and her voice upraised in protest against the motherly care wherewith Mrs. Adams insisted upon her changing her mud-stained garments. Deep as were the mysteries which my studies had taught me to solve, here was a human problem, which for the moment at least was beyond my comprehension. I had walked out on the moor in the forenoon, and on my return, as I topped the brow that overlooks the little town, I saw my fellow lodger some little distance off among the gorse. She had raised a light easel in front of her, and with papered board laid across it was preparing to paint the magnificent landscape of rock and moor, which stretched away in front of her. As I watched her, I saw that she was looking anxiously to right and left. Close by me, a pool of water had formed in a hollow. Dipping the cup of my pocket flask into it, I carried it across to her. "This is what you need, I think," said I, raising my cap and smiling.
Merci bien, she answered, pouring the water into her saucer. I was indeed in search of some.
Miss Cameron, I believe, said I. I am your fellow lodger. Upperton is my name. We must introduce ourselves in these wilds if we are not to be forever strangers.
Oh, then you live also with Mrs. Adams, she cried. I had thought that there were none but peasants in this strange place.
I am a visitor, like yourself, I answered. I am a student, and have come for the quiet and repose which my studies demand.
Quiet indeed, said she,
glancing round at the vast circle of silent moors, with the one tiny line of grey cottages which sloped down beneath us. And yet not quiet enough, I answered, laughing, for I have been forced to move farther into the fells for the absolute peace which I require.
Have you then built a house upon the fells? She asked, arching her eyebrows.
I have, and hope within a few days to occupy it.
Ah, but that is triste, she cried. And where is it, then, this house which you have built?
It is over yonder, I answered. See that stream which lies like a silver band upon the distant moor? It is the Gaster Beck, and it runs through Gaster Fell. She started, and turned upon me her great dark, questioning eyes with a look in which surprise, incredulity, and something akin to horror seemed to be struggling for a mastery.
"And you will live on the Gaster Fell?" she cried.
"So I have planned. But what do you know of Gaster Fell, Miss Cameron?" I asked. "I had thought that you were a stranger in these parts."
"Indeed, I have never been here before," she answered.
"But I have heard my brother talk of these Yorkshire moors, and, if I mistake not, I have heard him name this very one as the wildest and most savage of them all." Very likely, said I, carelessly. It is indeed a dreary place.
Then why live there? She cried eagerly. Consider the loneliness, the bareness, the want of all comfort and of all aid, should aid be needed.
Aid? What aid should be needed on Gaster Fell? She looked down and shrugged her shoulders.
Sickness may come in all places, said she. If I were a man, I do not think I would live alone on Gaster Fell.
I have braved worse dangers than that, said I, laughing. But I fear that your picture will be spoilt, for the clouds are banking up, and already I feel a few raindrops. Indeed, it was high time we were on our way to shelter, for even as I spoke there came the sudden, steady swish of the shower. Laughing merrily, my companion threw her light shawl over her head, and seizing picture and easel, ran with the lithe grace of a young fawn down the furze-clad slope, while I followed after with camp stool and paint box. Deeply as my curiosity had been aroused by this strange waif which had been cast up in our West Riding hamlet, I found that with fuller knowledge of her, my interest was stimulated rather than satisfied. Thrown together as we were, with no thought in common with the good people who surrounded us, it was not long before a friendship and confidence arose between us. Together we strolled over the moors in the mornings, or stood upon the moorstone crag to watch the red sun sinking beneath the distant waters of Morecambe. Of herself she spoke frankly and without reserve. Her mother had died young, and her youth had been spent in the Belgian convent from which she had just finally returned. Her father and one brother, she told me, constituted the whole of her family. Yet when the talk chanced to turn upon the causes which had brought her to so lonely a dwelling, a strange reserve possessed her, and she would either relapse into silence or turn the talk into another channel. For the rest, she was an admirable companion, sympathetic, well-read, with the quick, piquant daintiness of thought which she had brought with her from her foreign training. Yet the shadow which I had observed in her on the first morning that I had seen her was never far from her mind, and I have seen her merriest laugh frozen suddenly upon her lips, as though some dark thought lurked within her to choke down the mirth and gaiety of her youth. It was the eve of my departure from Kirby Malhouse that we sat upon the green bank in the garden, she with dark, dreamy eyes looking sadly out over the sombre fells, while I, with a book upon my knee, glanced covertly at her lovely profile, and marvelling to myself how 20 years of life could have stamped so sad and wistful an expression upon it. "You have read much," I remarked at last. "Women have opportunities now such as their mothers never knew. Have you ever thought of going farther, of seeking a course of college or even a learned profession?" She smiled wearily at the thought.
"I have no aim, no ambition," she said. "My future is black, confused, chaos. My life is like to one of those paths upon the fells. You have seen them, Monsieur Upperton. They are smooth and straight and clear where they begin, but soon they wind to left and wind to right, and so mid rocks and over crags until they lose themselves in some quagmire. At Brussels my path was straight, but now, mon Dieu, who is there can tell me where it leads?"
"It might take no profit to do that, Miss Cameron," quoth I, with the fatherly manner which 20 years may show towards one. "If I may read your life, I would venture to say that you were destined to fulfil the lot of woman, to make some good man happy, and to shed around in some wider circle the pleasure which your society has given me since first I knew you."
"I will never marry," said she, with a sharp decision which surprised and somewhat amused me.
"Not marry? And why?" A strange look passed over her sensitive features, and she plucked nervously at the grass on the bank beside her.
"I dare not," said she,
in a voice that quivered with emotion. "Dare not?"
"It is not for me. I have other things to do. That path of which I spoke is one which I must tread alone."
"But this is morbid," said I. "Why should your lot, Miss Cameron, be separate from that of my own sisters, or the 1,000 other young ladies whom every season brings out into the world? But perhaps it is that you have a fear and distrust of mankind? Marriage brings a risk as well as a happiness."
"The risk would be with the man who married me," she cried.
And then in an instant, as though she had said too much, she sprang to her feet and drew her mantle round her.
"The night air is chill, Mr. Upperton," said she,
and so swept swiftly away, leaving me to muse over the strange words which had fallen from her lips. I had feared that this woman's coming might draw me from my studies, but never had I anticipated that my thoughts and interests could have been changed in so short a time. I sat late that night in my little study, pondering over my future course. She was young, she was fair, she was alluring, both from her own beauty and from the strange mystery that surrounded her. And yet, what was she, that she should turn me from the high studies that filled my mind, or change me from the line of life which I had marked out for myself? I was no boy, that I should be swayed and shaken by a dark eye or a woman's smile, and yet 3 days had passed and my work lay where I had left it. Clearly, it was time that I should go. I set my teeth and vowed that another day should not have passed before I should have snapped this newly formed tie and sought the lonely retreat which awaited me upon the moors. Breakfast was hardly over in the morning before a peasant dragged up to the door the rude handcart which was to convey my few personal belongings to my new dwelling. My fellow lodger had kept her room, and, steeled as my mind was against her influence, I was yet conscious of a little throb of disappointment that she should allow me to depart without a word of farewell. My handcart with its load of books had already started, and I, having shaken hands with Mrs. Adams, was about to follow it, when there was a quick scurry of feet on the stair, and there she was, beside me, all panting with her own haste.
"Then you go? You really go?" said she.
"My studies call me."
"And to Gaster Fell?"
she asked. Yes, to the cottage which I have built there.
And you will live alone there?
With my 100 companions who lie in that cart.
Ah, books,
she cried, with a pretty shrug of her graceful shoulders.
But you will make me a promise.
What is it? I asked in surprise.
It is a small thing. You will not refuse me?
You have but to ask it. She bent forward her beautiful face with an expression of the utmost and most intense earnestness.
You will bolt your door at night,
said she, and was gone ere I could say a word in answer to her extraordinary request. It was a strange thing for me to find myself at last duly installed in my lonely dwelling. For me, now, the horizon was bounded by the barren circle of wiry, unprofitable grass, patched over with furze bushes and scarred by the protrusion of nature's gaunt and granite ribs. A duller, wearier waste I have never seen, but its dullness was its very charm. What was there in the faded rolling hills or in the blue silent arch of heaven to distract my thoughts from the high thoughts which engrossed them? I had left the great drove of mankind and had wandered away for better or worse upon a side path of my own. With them I had hoped to leave grief, disappointment and emotion and all other petty human weaknesses, to live for knowledge. And knowledge alone, that was the highest aim which life could offer. And yet upon the very first night which I spent at Gaster Fell, there came a strange incident to lead my thoughts back once more to the world which I had left behind me. It had been a sullen and sultry evening, with great livid cloud banks mustering in the west. As the night wore on, the air within my little cabin became closer and more oppressive. A weight seemed to rest upon my brow and my chest. From far away, the low rumble of thunder came moaning over the moor. Unable to sleep, I dressed and, standing at my cottage door, looked on the black solitude which surrounded me. There was no breeze below, but above the clouds were sweeping majestically across the sky, with half a moon peeping at times between the rifts. The ripple of the Gaster Beck and the dull hooting of a distant owl were the only sounds which broke upon my ear. Taking the narrow sheep path which ran by the stream, I strolled along it for some 100 yards and had turned to retrace my steps when the moon was finally buried beneath an ink-black cloud and the darkness deepened so suddenly that I could see neither the path at my feet, the stream upon my right, nor the rocks upon my left. I was standing, groping about in the thick gloom, when there came a crash of thunder, with a flash of lightning which lit up the whole vast fell, so that every bush and rock stood out clear and hard in the livid light. It was but for an instant, and yet that momentary view struck a thrill of fear and astonishment through me, for in my very path, not 20 yards before me, there stood a woman, the livid light beating upon her face and showing up every detail of her dress and features. There was no mistaking those dark eyes, that tall, graceful figure. It was she, Eva Cameron, the woman whom I thought I had forever left. For an instant I stood petrified, marvelling whether this could indeed be she, or whether it was some figment conjured up by my excited brain. Then I ran swiftly forward in the direction where I had seen her, calling loudly upon her, but without reply. Again I called, and again no answer came back, save the melancholy wail of the owl. A second flash illuminated the landscape, and the moon burst out from behind its cloud. But I could not, though I climbed upon a knoll which overlooked the whole moor, see any sign of this strange midnight wanderer. For an hour or more I traversed the fell, and at last found myself back at my little cabin, still uncertain as to whether it had been a woman or a shadow upon which I had gazed. For the 3 days which followed this midnight storm, I bent myself doggedly to my work. From early morn till late at night I immured myself in my little study, with my whole thoughts buried in my books and my parchments. At last it seemed to me that I had reached that haven of rest, that oasis of study for which I had so often sighed. But alas for my hopes and my plannings! Within a week of my flight from Kirby Malhouse, a strange and most unforeseen series of events not only broke in upon the calm of my existence, but filled me with emotions so acute as to drive all other considerations from my mind.